Hello there, I'm Chris Difford. Welcome to Series 2 of my podcast, I Never Thought It Would Happen. A podcast made in collaboration with my friends at the amazing charity Help Musicians. For those who don't know, Help Musicians was originally founded over 100 years ago by Edward Elgar, Vaughan Williams and some of their mates, with the aim to raise money for a musician friend that had sadly died and the family couldn't afford to bury him. Since then, they've expanded to provide support to thousands and thousands of musicians. They supply assistance with mental health and they provide financial support too. They have a wonderful mentoring scheme, developing skills and collaborating with fellow musicians. Throughout the pandemic, Help Musicians have provided £19.3 million to over 20,000 musicians. I find that absolutely inspiring. Joining me for the next hour is a lovely fella from Bury, Lancashire. He grew up with six siblings who helped nurture his love of music. He formed a band with a bunch of his mates, and they've all enjoyed an amazing journey together, including many Ivan Novellas, playing at the Glastonbury Festival, and composing for the London Olympics. And to top it all off, he found time to appear with Peter Kay on telly. He hosts his own weekly radio show on the BBC. Please welcome Mr. Guy Garvey. Guy Garvey, welcome to I Never Thought It Would Happen, a podcast for Help Musicians. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Thank you for having me. An honour.
It's lovely to see you and to hear you. What's COVID been like for you? The lockdown thing was wonderful for me.
Oh, was it? In terms of productive?
Well, it took me back. It was like 1973 all over again. I was kind of like in the days when I used to just sit on the floor stoned listening to Pink Floyd albums.
Okay. Ours was a bit busier than that, unfortunately. My mother-in-law, I married Diana Riggs' daughter.
Okay.
And Diana, pretty much as soon as the first lockdown happened, was diagnosed with cancer, which she died of a year ago, September. But she spent her last few months with us.
Oh.
Rachel nursed her in our home. So it was heavy, man. It was also, as you can imagine, with a character like Diana, incredibly uplifting and interesting. Yeah. And beautiful. The old cliche about the privilege of spending somebody's last days with them.
Yes.
Absolutely. A cliche for a reason. It really was an extraordinary privileged thing. But very, very productive for Elbow, because there was something tangible to throw all of our efforts into, you know. It's a very open process, our writing. It's completely collaborative and can come from anybody at any time in the band.
Right.
And then suddenly we had this unspoken but common goal, I suppose.
That's amazing. So you all kind of get together in a room and write together?
No, they all still live in Manchester. But even before I moved to London, before I fell for a Londoner in Rachel, we've been together 30 years now. And I'd say maybe 10 years ago, we realised that if we were to continue, we had to change it up. And the way we write now is very slow, but very different. I think it took us 20 years to realise that you're not angry just because you're shouting over an amplifier. And yeah, so now we piece it together very carefully. We work individually and send each other ideas. So actually, work-wise, it wasn't that different for us. The way that everyone else was forced to work was the way we'd been choosing to work for some time.
So was it like that at the very beginning?
At the very beginning, no, it was shouting over amplifiers. I'd storm out at least once every rehearsal, every what we call pracky, which was writing, recording, rehearsing, whatever. I'd storm out at least once. I was very hot-tempered in the early days.
Yeah, I love the storming out.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the storming back in that's not so great.
Not with your tail between your legs.
Yeah, there's no other way of doing it, is there?
There's an incredible chemistry when you form a band, I think, you know, especially when you're a teenager, because everybody's sort of sailing in the same direction together. You all want the same thing. Was that very much the same for you guys?
Oh, yeah. And those wonderful conversations about what kind of band we are.
Yes.
I remember the first band I was in when I was 14. We never played a show. We'd get together on a Saturday afternoon in a scout hut. We were called Synoptic Reverb.
No.
Yeah, still not very good with the names. But we never played a show. We'd just hang around under a railway bridge and smoke, looking like a band.
Yeah, good look.
I mean, it's so much about being in a gang, don't you think?
It is. I mean, when I was living with my mum and dad on a council estate, I was in a gang of skinheads. And then when I formed a band, I wanted it to be another gang.
Yeah.
But then as you get older and everybody sort of disappears into family life, it becomes less of a gang.
Yeah. Do you know what? The first time I met Neil Finn, we were over in New Zealand, and very flatteringly he came to the show and he bobbed in his head in the dressing room beforehand, and we exchanged, you know, big fan kind of dialogue. Thank you very much, Bill. I've just been brought a cup of tea by the lovely Bill.
Lovely.
Yeah, Neil Finn bobbed his head into the dressing room and he said, oh, you know, love your music. We would say, we love your music. And then he said, do you guys take your family on tour? And we said, no, we haven't. And he went, don't, split my fucking band up. And, all right, cheers. It's like he felt he had to impart it immediately.
Right.
In case he forgot. Yeah.
Yeah. So before all of that, when you were first expressing yourself as a songwriter, what was that like? Were you prolific at school?
I was a good student till I was 13. I was in the top band for everything, and I've got five older sisters, Chris, and they were all academic wizards. So there wasn't pressure, there was just an assumption. And then at 13, I couldn't tell you why, I just downed tools. I used to blame it on my parents' divorce, but then my mum pointed out that I actually stopped working before their divorce. So I can't blame them anymore. But if I liked the teacher, I liked the subject. So I had a great English teacher called Mrs. Edwards. And actually, probably the first writing I did, she encouraged us to write poetry, but you were also allowed to rap.
Whoa.
And this is the era of sort of just before gangster rap, because it was gangster rap that kind of put me off hip-hop. I loved all the sort of Sugar Hill Gang, Grandmaster Flash era, and I'm still very much attached to P-Funk and sort of all the George Clinton stuff in my head. It was the out there wackiness of it that I loved, and the grooves. But anyway, yeah, so we'd write raps, and I think that was probably the first writing and performing I did.
Do you still have any of those original lyrics?
I'm afraid not, no. I do have my journals from being 14, but I haven't got any of the raps, unfortunately. I don't know why they're not in there. That's a blessing.
I've got all my stuff up here, sadly, but when I'm tempted to read it, I go, oh, my God, was that where I began?
Can you remember your first song, Chris?
Well, the first lyric would have been a very fanciful lyric inspired by Damon Runyon's story.
Oh, yeah.
He used to be a short story writer from New York.
I know exactly who he is. Guys and Dolls, right?
Guys and Dolls, yeah. And so it was kind of, it was written about a murder backstage at a theatre. It was called Covent Films. Very fanciful.
Yeah, brilliant. Like a big one, a big concept.
It was a big concept that went on for verses. Have you ever written a song with, like, loads of verses in the kind of Dylan-esque way?
I wrote a duet for Richard Hawley and I.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, it was on The Seldom Seen Kid. And by the way, The Seldom Seen Kid as a title was a nickname my father had for one of his work colleagues who was never at work. He was always away on union business. So he was known as The Seldom Seen Kid. In the context of the album, I'm referring to my friend Brian Glancy, who died in 2007, and give him the nickname for the same reason. But originally, it was a Damon Runyon character. So, yeah, it's called The Fix. The duet's called The Fix. I met Hawley. We did this fantastic show for cash. We went to Lynchburg, Tennessee, and played at the Jack Daniels Distillery. And it was me, Hawley, and Black Francis, and we were playing with Muscle Shoals, Spooner Oldham on the keys. These are fantastic old guys. And we were encouraged to do two of our own songs, but versions of, with Muscle Shoals as a backing band, and a cover. And I fell to pieces, a little bit like I did when I first met you. I fell to pieces around my heroes initially. And I didn't have words for Black Francis. I just couldn't believe it. And bless him, he sensed my nervousness when we were introduced. And a few minutes later, he wandered off somewhere because I literally couldn't speak. And he came back a few minutes later and he said, "Dear Guy, my wife simply wouldn't forgive me if I didn't have a photograph taken with the lead singer of The Elbows." And I thought, you beautiful liar. You know, he was just upon my ease. Hawley and I became firm friends. He rocked up to the airport with a six-pack of Guinness and battleships, the MB game battleships.
Okay, yeah.
And he was like, "I got us battleships to play on the plane, our kid. Are you into it?" And I was like, "Yeah." And we drank Guinness and yeah, we planned this duet. And the duet's about fixing a horse race. I've never been in a betting shop in my life. I had to go and study
the form, as it were.
Exactly. I had to go in and learn all the terminology, and this very bored young woman with the most elaborate fingernails you've ever seen, from sitting there for hours and hours, told me everything I needed to know about horse racing. And I wrote this epic song. And the story of it is, these two guys have fixed a horse race and they're gloating and rubbing their hands together about what is going to happen, you know. And then what was supposed to happen in the song was, it transpires, neither of them have put the bet on. And then it was supposed to descend into insults in a kind of fairy tale in New York kind of way. But it was too much. There was too many verses for the song. So it just ended up being the gloating part. But it was great to be able to put words in Richard Hawley's mouth. That was great fun.
Well, he turned up backstage at one of Jules's shows a couple of weeks ago that I was singing at, and he turned up with a six-pack of Guinness, so things haven't changed.
Good lad. Yeah, he likes a Guinness, as do I. It has to be said.
So what was your bedroom like? Paint a picture of it. I mean, for me, I had, like, a picture of... Well, I had a poster of the Beatles, had a poster of The Who, a girl with a tennis racket, with a tennis...
I know the one.
You know the one. So what sort of stuff did you have on the wall?
Well, I shared a room with my brother until I was 15, and Mum kicked me out when I was 17. For the couple of years, it was my own room. What did I have on the wall? I honestly don't remember, but the house was cold. My Mum was brought up even further north. I'm from Bury, which is 6-7 miles north of Manchester. She came from Cone, which is kind of Blackburn way. And she grew up in she was poor. We were poor. Although we didn't realise it, that old chestnut. But the house was cold. It was heated by a coal fire, and Mum was, she watched the pennies. So it was bloody cold. So I feel like whenever I was in my room, I was under the duvet, whether I was going to bed or not. I had a black and white portable TV, which Mum thought was a computer monitor. I used to trawl the airwaves, desperately searching for a pair of breasts as a teenager.
As you do.
With the volume down. I mentioned the telly because I watched a film called Three Women in Love. It's not the famous one. It was, I think, a German film, and it was kind of a fanciful, pretentious adult fairy tale about a young man who's a poet / philosopher, and he falls in love with three different women, and it tortures him. You know, he's rapturously in love with all three of them, and it tortures him to the point where he becomes really ill and he wanders the streets. And then it turns out that they are his muses, and they've been sent to inspire his poetry, and it's okay to love all three of them. The end. Right? And I thought, I think I want to do that for a living.
Yes.
I want a garret. I want my own garret.
Were you a fan of Top of the Pops, Under the Duvet?
Oh, yeah. And the countdown was very much a family affair.
Yeah.
You know, cheering for the ones you like, booing the ones you didn't like.
Which was the ones you didn't like?
Now then.
Because they're the ones that I didn't like then, I kind of like now.
Like what? Give me a for instance.
Well, you know, things like Peters and Lee, I didn't really get. You know, the guy, I couldn't figure him out at all. It just seemed like he was onto something that he didn't know about. But listening back, the songs were very well written. They were crafted, you know, they were proper songs.
I'll have to have a listen. What are their famous ones?
I can't remember, but there's one album cover that I saw in an Oxfam shop that I had to buy. I haven't got it here, otherwise I should show you, but he's very well hung on the album sleeve. I know he was blind and stuff, but if you'd done the album shoot and then you would have gone, hold on a minute.
Yeah, just wait one moment. Yeah. Like Bowie in Labyrinth. I think that was some kind of awakening for my wife. It's like, I suppose Top of the Pops was like, I immediately think of Mel and Kim. And that sort of era. I wasn't a fan of Paul Young.
No.
I remember that because I would boo Paul Young, whereas my sisters would cheer.
Of course.
And we all loved Adam and the Ants.
No.
I didn't like Duran Duran. And again, I came to Duran Duran through Pete, the bass player in Elbow. It came full circle, and he played me their music and told me why he loved them, and I came round. Yeah, so that's one I came round on, yeah.
And Cliff was always on.
Oh, Christ.
He's still on. If there was Top of the Pops today, he'd be on it covered in dry ice.
Yeah, no, Cliff, bless him. I feel like he should be actually called Cliff, bless him.
What was the first band that you went to see live? Was that an experience that you'll never forget?
Well, I went to a pantomime which was performed and hosted by a band called, oh, now then, they were named after a rugby club. The Orton Weavers.
Nice name.
Right, so the Orton Weavers were they were local to the Northwest. They were always on the regional news and named after the rugby club, and they'd do sketches in between songs, and some of the songs were covers. And I went to see a pantomime with them in, but I remember the sort of starry-eyed thing. Oh, my God, There's the Orton Weavers. Years later, I'm being driven to meet the tour bus very early morning, and the guy behind the wheel is way too gregarious and loud for 5 a.m. whatever it was. And he said, so where are we off to today? So I just sort of said, work. And he says, well, what's the work? And I'm trying to avoid telling him I'm a musician, because I don't really want to talk, you know. I'm not being rude, but... And eventually I kind of say I'm in music. And he says, oh, right, do you write your own material? Which, I love that question. And I was like, yes, it's all our own material. So he says, I used to be in your game. I was like, oh, yeah. So he says, some of our own material, some covers, some sketches. Do you remember the Orton Weavers? I was like, yeah. And he went, like them. Oh, right. But the first band proper I went to see were Ride.
I don't know them, I don't think.
It was shoegaze. It was kind of My Bloody Valentine.
Oh, shoegazing time, yeah.
Yeah, and it was epic. It was distortion to the point of symphonic. At the time, they did this thing where they really didn't move, bar the drummer. They were motionless, and they were all dressed in white. And I never saw them do it before or since. It was like a thing they were trying, perhaps. And the room was going bananas, and I lost a shoe. And I waited until the venue was empty to try and find my shoe, and it was gone. Some bastard had my shoe.
No.
So I went home with a wet sock. What was yours, Chris?
Well, David Bowie, and it was a college just down the road from where I lived, and it was 1972. He came out on stage on his own with his 12-string guitar and played about 6 songs, and then he brought his band on, which turned in to be The Spiders.
Wow.
And everybody in those days sat on the floor watching gigs, and it was a real experience to sit there and to have this smiling face like right in front of you delivering such incredible lyrics.
Wow.
And with that, I walked home, got a bag of chips and decided that that's what I wanted to do.
Right. That was the trigger.
It was. Did you have a similar trigger?
It's a strange one. I don't remember sort of a single cinematic thing. My sister Becky is a huge influence on me. She played me a lot of the music I still love, but she told me why she loved it. And she's very poetic. She describes things very well. She still contributes to my programme, my BBC radio programme. And it was listening to her talk about music and why she loved it. I remember the profound effect that sort of mellower Genesis tunes had on her. She was like, listen, there's a story in here. It's almost like a bedtime story.
Yeah.
And I'd focus on the lyrics. And when I realised that the words, if you listen to the words, that it had more of an effect, I thought, I want to do that. And I wrote poetry, actually, all the way through school. I tried to write poetry. It's funny, actually, when I look back through my journals, I'm not very good, and I continue to be that standard into my mid-20s.
Well, you have to have life experiences, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's right. And also, I think when you realise there's no rules, there's a lovely quote that my friend Dean Hughes is a great artist and a wonderful man. And Michael Craig Martin, the artist, said that he makes things so he can have a look at them.
Oh.
Yeah, and it's like, it's that. It's like when all the anxiety about being judged dissipates and you realise you're allowed to write a shit song today if you want. And actually, I feel like when I sit down and I do some work and I don't like it at the end, I always feel like it'd just be there in the pipe the next time I sat down. So it never feels like a waste of time.
I agree.
Yeah. And in the same way as Michael Craig Martin wants to look at something so he makes it, I want to listen to music. I love listening to music. And you can boil it all down to the question, what do you want to hear next?
Sure, yeah. How do you let the songwriter into your room?
Well, some days I feel like I have something of great import on the tip of my brain and I just need to access it, and I lock the door. Nobody ever comes into this room unless they're bringing me a cup of tea. But if it's important, I'll lock the door. And then other days I feel like an old man tinkering with a vintage car.
Yes.
Yes. You know? I call it housekeeping, days like that.
Yeah.
You know, do some editing.
So you've got a great discipline then. That's lovely to hear.
Office hours, yeah. Oh, since I became a dad, yeah. I'm here 10 o'clock till 4 o'clock.
Well, that's sort of the Randy Newman school of writing, isn't it?
Is that how he does it?
Yeah, he goes in at 9 in the morning and then he has lunch at midday or 1 o'clock and then he goes and spends the rest of the afternoon writing, which... And I applaud him for that.
Yeah. It's a lovely thing. I can't believe I'm allowed to do it still. I can't believe I'm allowed to do it for a living. So
it's a real gift, isn't it?
It is. And actually, I'm quite a placid person. I'm quite a jolly fucker. But the one thing that makes me insanely angry, like I cannot control my temper, is if I'm expecting to be able to work and for some reason I can't, it makes me very irrational.
That's interesting.
Yeah, isn't it? It's just like... On the one hand, I see it as this great privilege. And obviously, my temper tells me that I obviously see it as a right I've earned. You know?
Yeah. It's really interesting you say that. I felt very angry yesterday because I wasn't sitting in here working. I was sitting in the house down the end of the garden. And when I went to bed, I was kind of thinking, right, I've got to reinstate the discipline. I've got to get the songwriter back in the room.
If we knew how to do it every day, we'd do it every day. It's just one of them things, isn't it?
Alongside my guests, in each episode, we also like to feature the story of a musician who has benefited from Help Musicians and whose career has been supported or even saved by the charity.
My name is Laura Wilkie and I am from a little place called Tain in Ross-shire, right in the Highlands of Scotland, north of Inverness. And I grew up playing and learning folk music and then moved to Glasgow to study music and had previous issues with an eating disorder when I was in my teens and very early 20s. Long story short, I was in the Priory Hospital in Glasgow for a year. But going to the Priory actually really, really helped. I just kind of surrendered. I was like ready. Anyway, I got better from that and I was doing really well and I was just really busy getting lots of session work, lots of touring. But what was happening at that time was that I experienced a lot of pain in my abdomen. Sometimes I'd be sick and so I just kind of eventually began to burn out. So I neglected practice for sleeping most of the time or trying to rest before I had to work or do anything. And I got this gig at the Edinburgh International Festival for a theatre production. And the gig happened every day at like 3 till 4:30. So I used to come back to Glasgow and I was just finding it so difficult gigging and dealing with this thing that I didn't, you know, my doctor couldn't tell me what was wrong with me. I'd seen a couple of different gastroenterologists who were like, don't really know how to help you. It just felt like I wasn't really here. It felt like I was a bit just sort of detached from reality, and I felt like I just had to give up music. It was like my career was just like falling through my fingers. You know, I got into very dark places. I felt like there was no way that I could carry on living because I was so like financially unstable, and I felt like it was all my fault and I should never have chosen this career, and I'd never heard of help musicians. I didn't even know exactly what I needed help with. I just said like, hi, I've been recommended to get in touch with you. I'm struggling with an ongoing physical condition, which is undiagnosed. So they saw that I was needing financial help and they gave me some money to get out of my arrears. And they said, we'd like to offer you a therapy grant. And honestly, that got me out of a really deep hole. I saw a dietitian. All of that came from help musicians. I now have a diagnosis years on. I have an aperiostatic esophagus, which is not curable. And so I'm able to now function, and I've got the time to practice. I've got the time to work, and they're trying to look for ways that they might be able to help you that you might not even have thought of. For example, the girl that came around to visit me one time, she spotted my yoga mat and said, oh, do you do yoga? And I said, yeah, you know, like I try and do that. I notice a difference in my mental well-being when I've been practicing yoga. And she said, we can help you with yoga classes and we can provide that for you. I wouldn't even have thought of that, but they were just trying to find any way that they could possibly make my life easier, you know, facilitate my career to the best that they could. I cannot speak more highly of all of the help musicians team. It's just amazing. They've picked me up and picked me up again, you know, when I've struggled. They just want to keep nurturing musicians so that we can make the best music that we can, and in turn, I suppose, like provide the best music that we can for the world.
To find out more about the wonderful work help musicians do, have a look at their website for loads more information, and please subscribe to this podcast. The connection between the words and the audience is a wonderful experience. How do you embrace that?
We did a bunch of shows in September. I'm really pleased to say we managed to do 22 dates without COVID fucking up in any way. Testament to our crew being wonderful and sticking to the rules as well. Mm. And even more than usual, you could see what people had been through. Everything was just amplified. There was a great feeling of release in the room when we were overjoyed to set foot on the stage every night on account of not knowing till midday if everyone had tested negative. So every single show felt like a triumph, and we assumed it would be the last one.
Mm.
And then in the room, the people who'd decided to come, I mean, the rooms felt full, but there was a 40% no-show. And I was very interested to find out that the usual no-show for rock and roll gigs is 10%.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Isn't that remarkable? That's what promoters assume under normal circumstances. And I'm like, wow, that wouldn't happen at the theatre.
Mm.
Isn't that strange? But the people who were there who'd made the decision to come out, obviously it was still a risk. I guess they'd committed to the idea and they fully immersed themselves in it. And you saw people laughing hysterically. You saw people crying. Mm. You saw people holding each other, and they'd obviously lost somebody. And again, immense feelings of privilege. I think because Elbow are a collaborative outfit, I don't feel ownership of the songs. I feel joint ownership. I feel very, very happy to be part of it. And also, we've all said this in our various ways down the years, but the music is a thing that none of us feel. It's almost like it'd carry on if we weren't there.
Yeah.
It's like bigger than some of the parts. It's like there's still that thing of like looking at each other, and I know what's going through Mark's mind at any given moment. The guitarist in Elbow, Mark Potter, it was his band in the first place, and he's a very emotional man. And if he sees somebody being affected by the music, he can't help it. He chokes up. He gets very, very affected by it.
I know that feeling. But sometimes being in a band, you have that shining where you can sort of almost understand the conversation that's going on in somebody else's head when you're playing a song.
Yeah.
Just by looking at them. Especially, I mean, we've been together 40-odd years plus, and you know, it's second sense some of the time, which is a lovely thing, but sometimes it's hurtful too.
Hurtful how?
Well, just because sometimes you possibly don't think you can deliver quite as much as everybody is anticipating. You don't all get out of bed at the same speed. You don't all get on stage with the same thought, but you have the same ambition, I guess.
Yeah.
You want to be in a band, you want people to enjoy your songs.
Yeah, it's a privilege, isn't it?
It's a fantastic job. Were your parents supportive?
Dad, no. And, yeah, Mum, yes.
Mm.
You know, I bet we heard the same phrases. Safety net.
Mm. Have you thought of a real job?
Yeah, exactly. No, Dad didn't get it at all. And in fact, I don't think he did this consciously, but he would say that he'd come to a show and then something would happen and he wouldn't show.
Mm-hmm.
There was a similar thing too. Once I'd moved out of my mum's house, Dad would drive me back to my place after I'd visited him. And I'd say, do you want to come in for coffee, Dad? And he'd say, no, I've got to get off. But then we'd sit in the car and talk for an hour.
Mm.
And I think it was a strange territorial thing, you know, a dad and lad stag thing. And he would find an excuse to not come to shows quite often. And the first time he did come to a show, we were supporting Muse in the arena in Manchester.
Mm.
And we managed to wangle a box for our parents. They're glass-fronted boxes that you then go out and sit in front. But if you're in the box, you can't actually see the arena because of the reflections, etc. So my dad was being chatted up by my very charming friend, Katie, and holding his own. He was a charming man. And having a few beers in the box. And then as we came on stage, my sister took him out and she said she realised that he'd never been in a room that big because his jaw dropped when he walked through the door.
Mm.
My sister Gina said he spent the whole show asking her questions. Who's that there? That's the band's guitar tech. She's called Sharon. Does our guy employ her? yes, she's employed by the band. And literally that day, he was so overflowing with admiration and praise. He really didn't hold back, you know. And he was a bluff northerner, my dad.
Mm.
You could have predicted it quite the other way. Mm. He might have decided he was going to nail my feet to the floor with some criticism, but he didn't. He just gushed and gushed, and it changed our relationship. We had a very, very good friendship for the last 10 or 15 years of Dad's life.
What was his job of work?
He was a proofreader, mostly for the Daily Mirror.
Oh, wow.
For the Thompson Group in Manchester. He was grammar school educated. Mum and Dad were the first generation that could have free further education.
Mm.
And Dad's only regret was that he didn't take the opportunity. He worked in order to get money, but he was very, very bright and loved words. And he was a union man. He liked being of use to other people very much.
So he kind of passed the baton of words down to you in that way.
Yeah, well, my mum too. My mum's also very wordy and loves words. And I've got quite a good memory for lyrics, dialogue, things like that.
Mm.
And I think that comes from my mum.
What sort of music would your mum have liked?
Mum loves anything beautiful. So it can be Grace Jones, it can be The Orb, or it can be... She loved the Beatles.
Mm.
The way she talks about the Beatles, you know, she says things like, you don't know what it was like before the Beatles, guy. It was all fucking shite. And he said, and every record, everyone would say, oh, no, they've lost it. But they hadn't lost it. They just reinvented themselves over and over again. Jules said something that stuck with me, which I just thought of then. He was referring to Radiohead and how explosive OK Computer was when it came out. And Jules said, they reminded artists to be artists.
Mm.
And I think that's what happened with the Beatles as well. I think that constant what can be done from here kind of attitude, like, you know, hey, what can we do from here that nobody's done before?
Mm.
That spirit of exploration is definitely part of why Elbow do it.
Yeah.
Wild experimentation for years and years with Elbow, trying to find the new sound, you know.
Mm. Do you find that in the youth of today that they have that same ambition? Or has ambition been shortened down to like a 2-minute visual concept?
I spend most of my time here at the Dairy talking to people who are in for 3 days max. Mm. There are a few artists who work more long term. My next door neighbour is a lad called Barney Lister. He's a Yorkshireman and he's at the beginning of his career, but he won an Ivor Novello Award for Best Song this year with an artist called Abongjar.
Mm-hmm.
And Barney works incredibly hard. And what I've realised is that the people making music now and throwing themselves into it get no respect, along with the sort of financial rewards that you and I enjoyed.
Mm.
That's all out the window because it's so badly skewed at the moment. You know, it is literally highway robbery, what's going on. And along with that has gone the respect. You know, these writer-producers, I won't name them, but some at the top of their game, right? They've had serious success. Mm. And you'll see them kicking the heels one afternoon. You'll say, what's going on, man? He's like, my artist hasn't turned up. And you're like, has anyone phoned you? He goes, no, they don't phone you. and like, they'll deliver a song, you know, they'll be in for 2 days and they'll write a song with an artist. And the first time they know that it's been released is when they hear it on the radio. There's no respect. There's no manners. They don't even get a thank you for their work. And it's all throwing it at the wall as well. It's like they put people in a room together and they're spitballing and throwing these ideas together. If it does come out, they'll look at the credits and there's another 12 people they've never heard of being accredited with the publishing. Record company men getting executive production credits so that they get a slice because they made a phone call suggesting two people work together.
Mm.
And then if you do have a hit, it's an absolute pittance coming in.
Yeah.
So what I would say about artists today is they ain't in it for the money.
No.
They're given no respect and they work incredibly hard. But what's gone out the window with the investment that you and I had, you know, the opportunity to spend months on a record and have a producer whose job it was to bequeath this knowledge, which we're losing now, records don't sound as good. And the art isn't being polished. It's not being realised. I hear so much new music for my programme and more often than not, I'm thinking, Jesus, that song could be better with just a little more time, a little bit of investment. You can tell when, if a lead vocal's double-tracked, it tells me that the frontman or woman isn't confident enough yet.
Yeah. Well, you know, you very much did an apprenticeship by forming a band with lots of your friends and probably working in clubs and rehearsing loads, you know. So I don't see that very much now. I've worked in a few music colleges and people are being taught how to tune guitars and how to loop their guitar leads. And I'm thinking, hold on a minute, what about the storytelling? What about the emotion behind the song? There seems the empathy in the industry seems to have disappeared.
Yeah. I think it's all linked to the finances. I think it's the respect for the musician, for the artist has gone out the window. It's excuse me. I'm going to be honest with you, Chris. I've got my first hangover of the year.
Well, I'm glad I'm here to witness it.
it feels just like they used to. Yeah, the respect has gone out of it. It's like if music's free, it becomes disposable. If it's not coming back from the record shop with this precious item in your hot little hands, forming an attachment to the object is, you know, part of loving music as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, I used to have to get on a 53 bus and go to Oxford Street to HMV, which took an hour and a half to get, let's say, the Allman Brothers Live. So I'd get that as an import, I'd get on the bus, I'd go home. It's a double album. By the time it's 6 o'clock at night, I'm hearing it for the first time.
Yeah.
But my God, I'm still playing it now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but now if I hear something on Night Tracks on Radio 3, which I listen to, or on your show, which I also listen to, then I Shazam a track and then it's instantly on a playlist that I never play again.
Yeah, that's the thing. You just don't browse your record collection in the same way.
Although I have to say, I used Tidal as a streaming service, because on the screen you have all the album covers, so it actually looks like an album collection.
Oh, that's cool. They've adopted the user-centric model, haven't they? They're paying their artists properly.
Yeah, well, it's Jay-Z, I think, who runs it, or oversees it anyway. Yeah.
Do you want to hear my Jay-Z story?
Go on in, I'd love to.
So, I think it was 2013, I think. Maybe it was 2011. But Elbow just played on the Pyramid stage at Glastonbury, and Coldplay were headlining. And we know them boys going way back. We're sort of very, very close contemporaries of them. And we did our show. I got riotously drunk. My partner at the time was the novelist Emma Jane Unsworth.
Mm-hmm.
Chris was still with Gwyneth Paltrow. And he introduced me to Gwyneth. And all I was fixated on was getting her to tweet about my girlfriend's debut novel. So I was like, it doesn't matter that you haven't read it. Just tweet it, you know, and all this. And we were having a laugh, really laugh. And she introduced me to this delightful American couple. And I was chatting to the four of them for like, I don't know, half an hour. I was pretty drunk.
Mm.
And then my drummer's wife came over, and their son was there with them that year, Dylan. He was like 10 or something. And she said, can you ask if Dylan can have his photograph taken with Jay-Z and Beyonce? And I said, is that who that is? She said, are you fucking kidding me, guy? I have these chasmous holes in my pop culture knowledge. I walked into the studio the other day, again, Beyonce related, singing a song by Solange, Beyonce's sister. I was like, lads, I've heard this amazing tune. You've got to check this out. And they were laughing at me. I remember once Elbow's bass player coming in. Lads, I've got to play this song. It's beautiful. Honestly, I can't stop listening to it. He puts it on. Do-do-do-do-do-da-da.
Yeah.
It's Glen Campbell, Wichita lineman. And I'm like, are you fucking kidding, Pete? And he's like, what? I was like, nobody doesn't know this song. I'm the same.
Yeah. Chris Martin is somebody that I've been trying to track down for this show because I really respect what they've done. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, Coldplay, you know, I don't really like them. They're sort of like a bubblegum group in some ways. But they've kind of done almost what Queen have done. They formed a band for a reason.
Yeah.
As a business in some ways. But they've done it extremely well, and there is a lot of underlying emotion there.
And they've kept the band together.
Yeah.
They've done it properly as brothers. Their love for one another as well as the project is still there.
Mm.
And Chris has always been very, very generous in the way he talks about Elbow. Really helped us out. I have to say that, actually. We've been really lucky in terms of we've supported Coldplay and we've had Chris big us up. Because we've only got a couple of singles, let alone hits.
Mm.
You know, I'd say two. Actually, and the rest of it is not radio friendly, and we arrive at the audiences we've got round a circuitous route. The Mercury Prize in 2008 was massive, but then also that year we did, through an amazing lady called Leslie Douglas, who was the head of BBC Radio for a bit there, she had this idea to put us in Abbey Road with the BBC Concert Orchestra, and we performed our entire album with the Concert Orchestra. And because of the way the orchestras are paid, as you'll know, the union official is there and will stop mid-song if it's time for him to have a tea break. The musicians' union is fantastic for classical music.
Mm.
Fucking chocolate, fucking teapot for the rest of us.
Yes.
As we've observed over the last few years. But they look after their strings. Anyway, we had a 15-minute margin of error. So it was like, I always say, riding a unicycle on a tightrope. We couldn't make any mistakes.
Mm.
And there was an audience thrown into the mix.
Wow.
And it was on the red button. And the week that it was on the red button, on repeat, was the week that the country was snowed in.
Yeah.
And so we kind of had a 60 million people captive audience for a week. And it doubled our audience. But these are things of chance, you know. These are, you can't rely on awards. You certainly can't plan for advertising like that red button was. It was so lucky.
How do you fare in America?
Do you know the 9:30 Club in Washington, D.C.?
Very well. Played it many times.
it's the only place we've ever played in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
It hasn't grown beyond that.
Talking about the Musicians Union there for a moment, Help Musicians has given out £19.3 million during the COVID experience. And last week they started another funding round of over £1 million for songwriters who are on their arse, basically.
Excellent.
And lots of young writers who I've met online on Zoom calls and stuff who, you know, are thinking, well, there's no future for me. I'm going to go and do something else. That's so sad.
It is. It's criminal. If you believe that art reflects the spiritual well-being of an era, a country, for artists not to be allowed to be artists, to not be respected enough to be paid as artists, to not be given not just money to pay the rent, but the development of a studio and a producer, you know, these skills that are only passed down from producer to engineer, who eventually becomes a producer. I remember Nigel Godrich saying, we don't know how the doors of Notre Dame Cathedral were made because the skills have been lost in history. And that's what's happening to music production. It's like, you know, if you want a really beautiful, shimmering, rhythmic thing from a guitar, you can play it with a gloss brush, a paintbrush. It works particularly well with simple guitars like an SG or a Telecaster. And that was passed on from Brian Molko to Steve Osborne to Ben Hillier to me. And it's only when you're in a room with someone and experimenting on how to achieve a sound that you can pass this stuff on, you know. And the fact that a producer now has to write the song for you and he's only in for a day, and he's trying to keep the buzz up, you know. He's like, he's got to be the tea boy, he's got to be the entertainment, like a child's entertainer, as well as write the bloody song and produce and record it. Of course music's going out half-baked.
It is.
And then the pandemic is just like...
Who do you lean on when you feel desperate, you know, when you're feeling like, oh, shit, I don't know whether I can get through this?
Well, it's been tough for the band, you know. The toughest it ever got was... when we finally got a record deal, we'd been together 7-8 years, and Nick Angel signed us to Island Records. He's now a music supervisor. I think he kind of designed the role.
For himself.
Yeah, we were the last band to sign to Island proper before it was swallowed by Universal. And then we just finished making the album with Steve Osborne at Real World, Peter Gabriel's place. We'd spent an entire summer on it. We were so excited. And then there was this acquisition from Universal, and it came from the top. Anything that hasn't made money is off the books. And somebody said, this band haven't been given the opportunity to release the record they've been making for the past year. And it was repeated, anything that hasn't made any money is off the books. And we were sacked. Our manager went and found us another deal with EMI. And on the day before we were due to sign it, they got cold feet and pulled out.
Yeah.
That was the lowest ebb. It was horrendous. And we really didn't know what to do. And my best friend to this day, Peter Jobson, who's the bass player with I Am Clute, and is just about to release a stunning solo record that he's been working on for a long time. He loves Randy Newman, by the way.
Yeah.
He's like somewhere between Randy Newman, Tom Waits, and the Geordie Neil Diamond. It's really profound.
I can't wait to hear that.
It's so great. It's called Burn the Ration Books of Love, and it's absolutely beautiful. Anyway, he's a very softly spoken, dashing Geordie. Clint North Eastwood is one of his nicknames. And Peter heard about this and came and found me the following day, and he said, I've found you some money to release an EP. And I was like, where? So he said, this fella, he's got a label called Ugly Man Records. He's called Guy Lovelady. And he wants to give you a grand so you can release some of this music and keep moving forwards. And he was kind of telling me, really. And he'd managed to secure this money without the guy having heard a note. I also saw Pete once. We were in a hotel bar at Christmas time, shift change, and the bar manager, are you a resident of the hotel? No, we're not. Then I'm afraid you have to leave. We're dead pissed off. Pete looks around the bar and he goes, hang on a minute. And he sidles up to this chap, talks to him for about 30 seconds. The guy calls me over and orders us a double round and pays for it. And then off he toddles. And I was like, how the hell did you do that? So he said, I looked around the bar for the biggest, reddest nose, and I thought, there we go, there's a fella who knows what it's like to need a drink. So, yes, Peter's Geordie Charm also got us money to release our first EP. And then Mark Radcliffe and Mark Riley, when they were on Radio 1.
Lovely people.
Absolutely. My brothers, I love them. I didn't know them then, but Mark had released a song on Ugly Man Records with his band 20 years before. So when the new releases came over his desk, he saw the imprint. He was like, no way. I used to be on that label. And he played our EP, and the title track was a 7-minute song of ours called Newborn. And there was also a single edit of it, which was basically half the song. But they played the full 7-minute version on Radio 1 in the afternoon, 5 days straight.
Wow.
They played the whole thing. And they'd pretend they'd done it accidentally. Oh, I meant to play the single edit there. And it got us the attention of V2, and V2 got us to our first Mercury nomination.
That is incredible. Yeah, so I know that dark feeling when you're dropped. It's like, wow.
Oh, God.
We were dropped by A&M Records after like 6 albums or something, and we were like in tears, you know, what are we going to do now? And we got picked up by Warner Brothers for 1 album, then they dropped us, and then A&M picked us up again.
There you go. Well, this is it. We are inadvertently back on Universal.
Well, they own everything, surely. They probably even own that sofa that you're going to be lying on in
a
moment.
Totally, yeah. Yeah, very happy there as well, I have to say.
Oh, guy.
In fact, David Joseph, who's the boss, he's a wonderful man. When we delivered the Seldom Seen Kid, they picked us up, and my manager played quite a brave game of chicken with them. V2 was sinking as a label, and we managed to get off V2, but Phil wouldn't sign a deal with Fiction. He wouldn't play them any new music. He said, you can hear the new album when you've signed the deal. And they had a staring competition, and eventually they agreed. And we delivered the album without One Day Like This on it. And David Joseph gave me a phone call when he'd heard the record. And it had Grounds for Divorce and Mirable on there. So it was a strong record, and we were proud of it. But he phoned me up and he said, Guy, if you know, this is a wonderful album. We think it's your best work. If you tell me that it's done, we'll sell more records than you've ever sold before, and we're very, very proud to have you aboard. If you've got something that could help us at radio, if you've got another tune in you, I was like, well, given the mastering date's in 2 weeks and it's taken us 2 years to write those 10, I don't think we have, but we'll give it a whirl. And the following day, we wrote One Day Like This.
Fantastic.
Which is by far our biggest song. So, got to say, I owe it to David Joseph. We all do.
We all do indeed. He has our catalogue somewhere in his bottom drawer.
Yeah.
Well, Guy, thank you very much for spending this time with me, and I hope your hangover subsides considerably.
It's gone.
It's gone.
You've done it.
Am I a cure for hangovers? Oh, my God. So it's time to whip out the pencil and get your scribe's hat on.
Do you know what? If I ask my son, what does Daddy do for a living? He goes, baby, baby, baby.
Thank you so much, Guy, for your time. God bless you, man.
The pleasure's all mine. Always lovely to speak to you, Chris.
I feel I have so much in common with Guy. Our fascination with words, crafting lyrics, and the fact that we've collaborated with other people, but we stay close to our band. But I have to say, I've never played Battleships with Richard Hawley, and I've never hosted my own radio show. To find out more about the wonderful work Help Musicians do, have a look at their website for loads more information. And please subscribe to this podcast. Thank you once again for listening. Please keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Give Me Sugar production for Help Musicians.